Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 12. The Lecture at Warren. Mary Patterson was a born teacher. To be a successful teacher, it is necessary to love teaching. And Mary all her life had loved teaching. Her discursive talking, which Albert recalls so interestedly in one of his letters, her little school at San Bunton, her writings regarding slavery and other political issues, and now her eager advocacy of Quimby's teaching, or her own interpretation of it, all reveal that urge to teach which later on was to be put to such tremendous purpose. When she first conceived the idea of teaching and healing along the lines laid down by Quimby, it is impossible to say, but it seems reasonable to suppose, that her failure to make a permanent home for her husband turned her thought definitely in this direction. She was almost tragically in need of an objective in life, and this course seemed to offer her one. Be that as it may, the early winter found her back again in Portland, studying eagerly. Writing of these times, George Quimby, Dr. Quimby's son, who acted as his father's secretary, recalls the persistence with which Mrs. Patterson sought to grasp what his father was teaching. She learned from him, he writes, not as a student receiving a regular course, but by sitting in his room, talking with him, reading his manuscripts, copying some of them, writing some herself, and reading them to him for criticism. I have heard him talk hours and hours, week in and week out, when she was present, listening and asking questions. And so, in the spring of 1864, she set out on what was to be, whether she intended it or not, her first missionary journey. It came about in this way. Among Quimby's patients who were staying at the International Hotel in Portland at the time Mary was there were two women, Miss Mary Ann Jarvis of Warren, Maine, and Mrs. Sarah Crosby of Albion. The three women became close friends. Miss Jarvis suffered from asthma and was threatened with tuberculosis, while Mrs. Crosby was recovering from some kind of nervous disorder. All three were earnest students of Quimby's methods, and Mrs. Crosby and Miss Jarvis began to look more and more to Mrs. Patterson for further enlightenment. He, Quimby, told me many times, Mrs. Crosby declared years afterwards, that I was not so quick to perceive the truth as Mrs. Patterson. Mrs. Crosby and Miss Jarvis seem to have left Portland for their homes early in the new year, both greatly improved in health. But in March, Miss Jarvis had a relapse and wrote to Mary, begging her to fulfill at once a promise she had evidently made to both her and Mrs. Crosby to visit them in the near future. She had great faith in Mrs. Patterson's understanding of Quimby's teaching, and felt sure she could help her if she would only come at once. It was a definite call for help, and Mary, after doubtless talking it over with Quimby, decided to answer it and go to Warren. Her next letter to Quimby is written from there under date of March 31, 1864. It opens in a happy, engaging way, telling of her arrival at Warren after a hectic trip involving an all-night stopover. Next morning at 10 o'clock, got into a villainous old vehicle and felt a sensation of being in a hen coop on the top of a churn dash for 6 hours. When the symptoms began to subside, and so did the old cart. And then she goes on to tell of her friend, how warm was her welcome, and how anxiously she had been awaited, her hostess having expected her a day or two before. But she has good news. Miss Jarvis is better already, and it seems possible to detect in her account of the matter a strange new expectancy, as of one who tries something for the first time, and half doubt, all hope, begins to realize that perhaps, after all, she can do it. After telling Quimby that the Saturday before, Miss Jarvis had had a paroxysm of what she said, difficulty of breathing on account of the easterly wind, she continues, I sat down by her, took her hands, and explained in my poor way what it was, instead of what it was not, as she had understood it. In a little, her breath became natural, and to my surprise, even, she raised phlegm easily and has scarcely coughed since till today. So I have laughed at her about the wind veering according to P.P. Quimby. I say to her, why, even the winds and the waves obey him. There is a word about Mrs. Crosby at Albion, and how she looks forward to seeing her soon, quite a little about her own struggles to keep the faith, a plea to the little doctor to continue helping her, and then, in the end, what would seem to be an allusion pervaded with an unconscious pathos to Daniel. If I could have my husband with me and be at home, I would like it there. But if she could heal, she ought to be preaching and teaching, and very soon she began to be convinced that she could heal. Miss Jarvis is doing well, she writes to Quimby on April 5th, and I shall not stop here longer than is necessary to make her happy. On April 10th, a lame back and some other ailments have all gone. And then on April 24th comes the final triumph. When I came here, she could not do but a little housework. In 3 weeks, she did her washing, a thing she told me she had not thought of being able to do ever again. She never knows which way the wind blows now, east or contrarywise. It was clearly her business to preach and teach the word wherever and however she could. And so, in due time, there appeared in the post office and other marts in Warren this notice. Mrs. M. M. Patterson will lecture at the town hall 1 week from next Wednesday on P.P. Quimby's Spiritual Science Healing Disease, as opposed to deism or Rochester Rapping Spiritualism. The story of the lecture is contained in 2 letters to Quimby, one written on April 10th and the other on the 24th. It was thinly attended, but the precious few there were described by a lady present, the manufacturer's wife, as the upper tendum, while Mr. Hodgman, a man of 60 years old, said it was the nearest rite of anything he ever heard in Warren. I had no poetry at the close. 'Twas all truth. We'll read it to you, if you like, when next I see you. I have changed it to suit the occasion. She was planning to deliver it again. This seems to me a spiritual need of this people. The hearts of Warren folks, she finds, very respectful and kind. The lectures were not barren in results, for within a few days, Mrs. Fuller, the woolen manufacturer's wife, is writing to Mary, telling her she is sick, and asking Mary to help her. Only Mary hesitated. "I returned a note," she writes, "that I was not done with my pupillage yet, and recommended her to visit you." Meanwhile, she is evidently writing and thinking constantly and longing to be able to write and think more. "I long to be strong," she writes Quimby, "and then would I not be happy saying just what I wish to do and letting people read it?" "Doctor," she continues, "I have a strange feeling of late that I ought to be perfect after the command of science, in order to know and do the right. So much as I need to attain before that makes the job look difficult, but I shall try." When men, and above all women, revile me, to forgive and pity. When I am misjudged because misunderstood, to feel wisdom, forgive them, for they know not what they do. All things shall work together for good to them who love wisdom. If I could use my pen as I long to do and not sink under it, I would work after this model till it should appear a thing of beauty, which is a joy forever. This last sentence, in view of all that was to follow, is perhaps significant enough. Meanwhile, the road continued uphill for her all the way. The light and shade in her letters to Quimby are almost crudely vivid in contrast. The joy of being able to help others is overcast perpetually by the fear that she would not be able to throw off the griefs that she took upon herself in effecting a cure under Quimby's strange healing process. Albert's smoking, Miss Jarvis' asthma, threatened tuberculosis, and other troubles. When Miss Jarvis would come to my bed, it would invariably set me to coughing. And before I was sick, she had lost the least approach to a cough. Now she is coughing a little, but she can't get back, for I have borne her sins, and you have saved me. This strange doctrine of transference was to cling stubbornly throughout many years to come. It was indeed all too evident a hard path that Mary Patterson was trying to follow. But her faith remained unshaken. And sometime in the latter part of May 1864, she returned to Portland and for a month or more resumed her former day-by-day association with Quimby. It seems likely that one of their subjects of conference was Daniel. But whether the kindly doctor had anything to do with it or not, it was not long before Mary had determined to make yet another effort to bring about a better understanding with her husband. Daniel himself seems to have enjoyed, at this time, one of those splendid visions of a new heaven and a new earth which rose periodically above the horizon of life. This time, his vision was surely the greatest yet, for now his appeal was not to be to the few, or even to the many, but to all the world. And so, in the Lynn Weekly Reporter for June 11, 1864, appeared the following advertisement. "Dental Notice, Dr. D. Patterson would respectfully announce to the public that he has returned to Lynn and opened office in B.F. and G.N. Spinney's new building on Union Street, between the Central Depot and Sagamore Hotel. where he will be happy to meet the friends and patrons secured last year while in the office of Doctors Davis and Trow, and now he hopes to secure the patronage of all the rest of mankind by the exhibition of that skill which close study and many years of first-class and widely extended practice enable him to bring to the aid of the suffering. He is aware that he has to compete with able practitioners, but yet offers his services fearlessly, knowing that competition is the real stimulus to success, and trusting in his ability to please all who need teeth filled, extracted, or new sets. He was the first to introduce laughing gas in Lynn for dental purposes, and has had excellent success with it. Terms lower than anywhere else for the same quality of work. It was all, no doubt, a part of a mutual effort of the two to live together again. Mary must have read the advertisement with some misgivings, but she evidently determined to make the attempt and early in July returned to Lynn. It was all to no purpose, however. Daniel's periodic reformations were of briefer duration as the years passed, and Mary had hardly settled in their new home before she realized that her husband was just as he had always been, only worse. Previously, his obvious contrition for his failings had won from Mary forgiveness again and again. But now he did not bother to be contrite. The bad boy had become a rather down-at-heel Don Juan, and each time it took a larger dose of ill-doing to find a reaction in repentance. He was no longer an itinerant dentist, but he went away just the same for days and weeks at a time. Mary stood it as long as she could, but at last, when proof was brought to her of a particularly sordid intrigue on the part of the doctor with one of her friends, proof in the form of letters written by him, still preserved, which are unprintable in the warmth of their expression, she packed up her few things and once more sought refuge with Sarah Crosby and Albion, Maine. That Mary did not drive him to infidelity is shown by an affidavit in 1902 by his boarding housekeeper, R.D. Roncevelle of Littleton, quoting him as saying, "He could have had as pleasant and happy a home as anyone could want, if he had only done as he ought by Mary." Many years afterwards, Mrs. Crosby recalled how Mary arrived at her home in Albion, a small farmhouse on the outskirts of the town, almost destitute, without money or proper clothing, her only assets being her indomitable will and active mind. But the two women were genuinely devoted to each other, and Mrs. Crosby received Mary gladly. To Mary, a little farmhouse at Albion must have seemed a veritable haven of refuge, for not only was she cut off from her husband, but from her family as well. There is very little information on the point, but it would seem clear that Mary's devotion to Quimby and his teaching had by this time, the fall of 1864, led to a complete breach between her and Abigail. Her father, now an old man, over 80, was also estranged from Mary for some reason, as is shown by the fact that when he died, as he did the following year, he left Mary nothing out of a very considerable estate. The cause of Abigail's estrangement was, of course, Quimby. The doctor's failure to help her or her son had convinced her at last that he was what she had always thought he was, just a mesmerist, and that Mary was healed by her own faith. Mary would have none of such heresy, and so they parted. During the next 5 years of her life, Mary Patterson was often in the direst poverty, but she never asked Abigail for help again, and Abigail never offered to help her. They were, after all, bakers, both of them. Mary remained with Sarah Crosby at Albion for several months, and it was during her stay there that an incident or series of incidents occurred, apparently so alien to the general trend of Mary Patterson's thought about this time as to be quite baffling until explanation is sought quite outside the realm of any philosophic unfoldment. As has been seen, spiritualism at this period was one of the great subjects of talk and experiment throughout New England. The spirit circles of the 50s were still in eager existence, and the very fact that it demanded no equipment for its practice made it specially popular and available in out-of-the-way places and amidst out-of-the-way people. Mary Patterson at times was vigorous in her repudiation of spiritualism in any form. She made its denunciation the central point in her lectures at Warren, and in many of her letters to the papers on the teachings of Quimby, she is careful to point out that spiritualism has nothing in common with Quimby's doctrine. And yet, one day, as she and Sarah were sitting together in the parlor of the little farm at Albion, a strange thing happened. They had been talking, as they often did by the hour, about Quimby's teaching and about spiritualism, in which Mrs. Crosby was more than a little inclined to believe, when suddenly Mary stopped talking. She leaned backward and began speaking in a low, sepulchral voice. As the fascinated Sarah sat listening with all her ears, the voice explained, after the orthodox fashion, that he was Albert Baker, Mrs. Patterson's brother, and that he had been trying for some time past to get control of his sister in order to warn Mrs. Crosby against her. He told her that he was Mrs. Crosby's guardian spirit, and in spite of his great love for his sister, he felt he ought to tell her, Mrs. Crosby, that while Mary loved her as much as she was capable of loving anyone, life had been a severe experiment with her, and she might use Mrs. Crosby's sacred confidences to further any ambitious purposes of her own. The explanation of the incident usually put forward is that Mary, having failed to bring her friend round to her own strongly adverse views of spiritualism and all that went with it, took this way of proving to her how easily its manifestations could be faked. If this was so, she either badly underestimated her own powers of acting a part, or Mrs. Crosby's credulity. For Mrs. Crosby was convinced that the manifestation was genuine, and some 40 years later wrote a vivid account of the incident and subsequent happenings, insisting emphatically that the communications were beyond question. However this may be, Mary followed up her first success with other appearances. She even told Sarah, or Albert did through her, that if she would look in certain places, she would find letters from him. Sarah looked, and sure enough, there were the letters. The writing, it is true, was strangely like Mary's. The letters are still preserved, but that might be accounted for by a family resemblance. At any rate, such an explanation evidently more than satisfied Mrs. Crosby. Indeed, by the time the letters began to come, she was far beyond a touch of doubt. In her story, years afterwards, she declared that she believed implicitly in Albert's care and guardianship over her, that she derived constant strength and comfort from it, and that this spirit friendship was one of the most real she had ever known. Perhaps the main importance of the matter, at least to the present purpose, is the indication it affords of the confusion which pervaded Mary Patterson's thinking at this time. In many ways, the next 2 years, the 2 years that immediately preceded the incident which was to change her whole life, are the most difficult of all to appraise. They are years wherein there is no outward sign of development in any direction. After some months spent with Mrs. Crosby at Albion, she returns to Lynn, tries once again, valiantly, to make a home for her husband, is physically better. She writes for the papers, poetry, news items, gossipy reports of local happenings. She enters vigorously into temperance work, joins the Good Templars, is raised to the position of presiding officer, writes for them, and speaks for them, and becomes popular and sought after. There is more than a hint, however, from her own writings, that in spite of all the outward show of great happiness, there was a desolation in the heart of this woman at that time, such as she had never known before. Hope, deferred and deferred again, has made the heart sick. She has tried so many things, and so many things have failed her. She tries them over again with ever lessening hope. She plays with spiritualism, now as a medium and now as a clairvoyant letter writer, but even in her spirit letters, she has her brother begging her friend to love and care for his sister, because a great suffering lies before her. She can fool Sarah Crosby into well-being with a fake spiritualism, just as, years before, she had fooled the woman sick of dropsy into health with her unmedicated pellets. But she cannot fool herself into anything now any more than she could then. In the bleak days of January 1866 came the final blow, the death of Quimby. For the last few years of his life, he had been struggling manfully against an internal ailment, abdominal tumor, always declaring that if his wisdom was not strong enough to heal him, it was yet strong enough to hold the disease in check. But he gave himself ungrudgingly to his work, too ungrudgingly, and at last his wife and children, who had never shared his views, seeing him failing every day, prevailed upon him to give up and take a much-needed rest. And so, in the summer of 1865, he closed his office in Portland and retired to his boyhood's home in Belfast. But the end came swiftly. He failed a little each day and at last acknowledged that the task was beyond him. When his wife begged him to have a doctor, he consented. did everything the doctor told him to do, but only, as he put it, because he hoped thereby to comfort his family. He never thought that the doctor could help him, but calmly waited for the end. "I do not dread the change," he said to his son George, who was at his bedside during his last hours, "any more than if I were going on a trip to Philadelphia." He died on the morning of January 16, 1866. A few days later, there appeared in the Lynn Advertiser a little poem written by Mary Patterson on the death of P.P. Quimby, who healed with the truth that Christ taught. It is not great poetry, but the sincerity of its sorrow brings it almost within the light of the golden circle. Can we forget the power that gave us life? Shall we forget the wisdom of its way? Then ask me not amid this mortal strife, this keenest pang of animated clay, to mourn him less. And so her friend was gone. His kindness and humanity, which she was to remember and acknowledge all her life, Mary Patterson could enjoy no longer. His influence and power and omnipresence had passed from her life. In her book, Retrospection and Introspection, Mrs. Eddy raises the curtain for a moment on the bitterness of these years. "The trend of human life," she writes, "was too eventful to leave me undisturbed in the illusion that this so-called life could be a real and abiding rest. All things earthly must ultimately yield to the irony of fate, or else be merged into the one infinite love." And then she goes on to tell how that as these lessons became clearer, they grew sterner. How that, up to then, the clouds that surrounded her had always seemed to have a silver lining, but that now they were not even fringed with light. The world was dark. The oncoming hours were indicated by no floral dial. The senses could not prophesy a sunrise or starlight. So it was, she says, when the moment arrived of the heart's bridle to more spiritual existence. And then, looking back on it all through the perspective of the years, she could add simply, "When the door opened, I was waiting and watching, and lo, the bridegroom came."